Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. My name is Scott Linden. I'm the host, also the host of the television show Wing Shooting USA. I hope you watch that when you're done listening here, and over and over and over again on YouTube and Pursuit Up, etc., etc. Great podcast in store for you here. Evan Graham of Smart Work fame will be joining me in just a moment or two. We'll, of course, have a public access tip, this one down in the southwestern United States, some hunting strategy and dog handling advice, and of course, the soon-to-be legendary Upland Nation trivia quiz. It's all coming up right here on the Upland Nation podcast, right after a couple quick messages. And our first message is from my good friend, Fred Bohm at Sage & Breaker Mercantile. Learn more about Sage & Breaker's great heirloom quality dog care and dog care. That would be gun care and gun cleaning products, although I wish they would invent a dog cleaning product. Anyway, sageandbreaker.com is where you learn all that. Lots of excellent videos that you might enjoy, and I'll bet you if you watch a couple or three that you'll learn something about taking care of your gun that you didn't know before. Sign up for all the advance notice on the dozen new products that are in line coming down the pike right now at sageandbreaker.com. And ESP America, my hearing protection sponsors, Jack and everybody at ESP America understands the value of your hearing, not just in the field and on the range, but at home, and you preserve that hearing by taking care of your ears when you're pulling the trigger. Learn more about the options available to protect your hearing at espamerica.com. Now, joining me is a guy that I kind of got to know online, if you will, in some of the hunting and gun dog forums. Evan Graham has always contributed useful information of one sort. Very generous of you, Evan. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate you having me on.
You struck me as a guy who tried to stay positive, tried to help out whenever you could, and those are the things that, you know, this podcast is all about. Check me if I'm wrong on that, everybody. But, Evan, you are basically running seminars now built around this smart work concept. And I'm really kind of intrigued by the whole thing. Why don't you explain smart work to us?
Well, when I went to college late in life, I was in my late 40s. When I went back to college, I was a paramedic before. I went back to college, my wife and I, and became RNs. And I had shut down my dog training business for that period of time, and I wrote a journal, and because I realized over all those years I had learned a great deal about dog training, and I had studied from some great trainers, in particular two Hall of Fame trainers, D.L. Walters and Rex Carr, and I realized that there was a big volume of information, and that if you're not using it, you're probably losing it, at least to some effect. And so that's why I wrote the journal, and a pro trainer friend of mine from Alabama encouraged me to use that as the basis for a book. My brother-in-law, being a writer himself, he's in the diet and fitness industry, and he encouraged me to not write just one book, but write two or three and link them together so I can give more information to people in more detail and stage the training, which is logical to me because that's how I train. And that's how Smart Work came about. Smart Work is designed to maximize the available time and resources that a trainer has. Nearly all of us run into a wall now and then with places to train, people to train with, resources to train with, and we want to make the most of what we've got, and that's what this system was made for. That's why I called it Smart Work.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, there are so many of us out there who have day jobs of one sort or another, and finally somebody has taken that into account. Give me one example of how that might benefit some of us in one way, shape, or form.
Sure. My first book, Smart Work, Volume 1, It's actually titled Smart Work for Retrievers, Volume 1, Basics and Transition. Is written in a very logical progression and has a flow chart for progression in it. And the flow chart guides the trainer through a course of basics, which for retrievers takes about 6 months. And that flow chart shows you on one side the mechanical aspects, in other words, formalizing obedience, force fetch, basic handling, water force, and swim by. In the other column is a list of things that a dog should appropriately be doing in the field while they're going through those stages of training.
Okay, so we got the flow chart, Evan Graham, and now we want to practically apply it, if you will, in the field. We know what we're trying to accomplish, the outcomes. So then what?
Well, it's what we do with the dog, of course, that matters most in the end. And one of the things that newer trainers tend to do all the time is get ahead of their young dogs. They kind of want to push things a little bit. They find their dogs to be willing students, and they want to do things that are too advanced for them when they don't have enough skill to do it yet. And so that's why we follow the flow chart and take that to the field literally. In fact, the way the book was designed was to be taken to the field. The front and back covers are laminated so they don't get water damaged as easily, and it's spiral bound like a college lab text, so that you can open, there are note pages in it, blank note pages, and you can open it to that and make notes as you go about your dog and how he's doing and tolerating things. So you kind of know where you are with the dog. I encourage journal writing for dogs so you can look back and see if the dog had a speed bump somewhere in his training that is bothering his progression, or that he had a weak point. And where you are now, you might see that show up later in some other skill set. So taking it to the field, we go to the field in very basic form. I imagine that's also true with pointing dogs. What you demand of the dog in the field is very simple and very limited and low-key and upbeat. And that's, we try and do that for quite a long while. Following the flow chart, you're going to do only very basic fundamental things instead of getting ahead of the dog.
And by getting ahead of the dog, I'm pretty sure I get that because I do it all the time, and I also see it in my own little training group when I'm trying to help members of my club. Everybody has these aspirations for their dog, and they see other people, whether it's on Facebook or on TV, kind of doing all the things that they hope to do, but they don't realize there's 100 steps between where they are and where that other dog on TV or on Facebook is. Is that what you mean by getting ahead?
Yes. Yes. Over the dog's head. For example, with a retriever, if he's in this course of basics that I spoke of, if he's in that 6 month period of time, even though he's doing really well and tolerating that information real well, you kind of get tempted sometimes because, like I said before, these dogs tend to be good students. They're quick learners. You want to go out and you want to run blind retrieves, or you want to run multiple retrieves, or you want to insist on steadiness before the dog has been worked up to that point. And as you mentioned, there are lots and lots of little steps that lead up to steadiness, lots and lots of little steps that lead up to having handling skills. So the more you can avoid taking quantum leaps, the better.
Yeah, they seldom pan out, do they?
They rarely do.
I described it last Thursday night as not 10 or 15 good repetitions, but 110 or 115 good repetitions, and your dog is probably getting close to mastering whatever that skill is.
Spread out over the course of time.
Yeah, you can't do it in a weekend, that's for sure. You know, you handle a lot of dogs. You've trained a lot of dogs. You've won some prizes. You've got some award-winning dogs and some blue ribbons of various sorts. And then you also wrote for Retriever Journal and Hunting Retriever Magazine. What are some of the more general challenges we face as, let's call ourselves amateur dog trainers?
Well, I've mentioned one of the most important ones, and that's not getting impatient. But as far as mechanically goes, I'm speaking here because I'm a retriever specialist of what the typical retriever trainers run into problems on. They, for example, go to the field and start shooting over a dog when he's not been what a lot of people used to call a gun broke.
Mm-hmm.
He's not conditioned to gunfire. Because that can cause a problem that may never be solved or take a heck of a long time to solve, creating gun shyness. Unfortunately, it's a common error. People do some pretty crazy things to condition their dogs to gunfire, like taking them out to a trap range or something, as if just a baptism of fire is going to solve that conditioning need. Worst thing you could do. Other things are exposing them to water that's too cold, to distances that are too great to work at, and demanding too much of them, in multiple retrieves, doing doubles and triples before they're doing singles very well, that kind of thing.
Well, I'll tell you, those are the questions I get every day on Facebook and at my website. And it's good to hear that everybody's facing them. If you had to kind of boil it down on the gun shy question, just for the record, because this is one of the most common questions I get in Reader's Digest form, how would you describe the right way to introduce a dog to gunfire?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is the distance of the gunfire. I don't think it's necessary to break it down as far as some people who are well-meaning tend to do, and that is to find a cap gun or beat on the lid of a trash can or something to provide that sudden noise. I instead just have my helper go out to a 50, 60, 70-yard distance with a regular blank pistol and point it away from the line, point it away from the dog, so that the gunshot is not very loud. And the other thing, and it should go hand in hand, and that is to associate it with something the dog loves, and that's marked retrieves, the visible fall. So after the dog's retrieved a few times comfortably at 50, 60 yards and is excited to go some more, then you have your helper yell and throw the bird, and while the bird's in midair, fire another shot and release the dog quickly. And the shots, it's so quiet at that distance, it's not very intimidating. You could, if you wanted to, or if you had an old cap pistol that maybe you saved from the past, use something like that, but that's just not what I've done for ever.
Yeah, it sounds like the key is exactly what I was taught and what I try to teach now, and that is associated with real birds and having fun out there.
Absolutely.
Now, let's make a quick switch. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. That's Evan Graham, retriever trainer. But I'm gonna throw a curveball in a moment, Evan, so prepare yourself. Dig into the batter's box here. Evan-Graham.net is where you find out more about the Smart Work program, videos, books, and everything else Evan has done, including all the accolades and prizes for dog performance that he has received. Evan-Graham.net. All right, so you're a retriever guy, and virtually everybody I know who owns a pointing breed can use help with retrieving. If you had to, have you figured out, is there one problem we all have in the upland world, in the pointer world, that you can help us solve in that world?
One of the most important skill sets, and unfortunately still, after all these years, one of the least understood, is force fetch. And that's beneficial for retrievers and pointing dogs alike. And conditioning that mouth and organizing their skills is critically important. And fortunately, over all these years, it's become a much more sophisticated process, much easier on the dogs. It's much more incremental in the way that it's taught. And it's very, very important, no matter what the dog's going to do for a living. And one of the most important things to understand about it is it's not just about delivery of the bird to hand. It's about pressure conditioning and stabilizing the dog's responses.
All right, you'll have to explain pressure conditioning, and then I've got a very personal and selfish question that probably is related to that, Evan.
Okay. So pressure conditioning the dog to pressure. They're all going to encounter pressure in their lives, especially a gun dog, any kind of gun dog. And the pressure, most of all, is what the dog perceives that it is. So it's going to be a surprise, something that happens in the field. Pardon me. Something unexpected. It's going to be maybe another dog that comes out of nowhere. I'm sure you've never had that happen when you're out hunting.
I'm laughing with everybody. That's a perennial story in our training group.
Well, it's happened to everyone, no matter what kind of dog they shoot over. And it disrupts, not only disrupts your hunt, but it disrupts your dog's concentration on the task. And so we do a type of pressure conditioning that is, again, like all skill sets, it's taught incrementally. We start in a basic form and work our way to more sophisticated things. With conditioning to pressure, we start conditioning to pressure with the very simplest of skills, like the command hear or come, whichever you prefer, to call the dog to you. That's initially just taught with treat training. But that's just teaching. Formal training, which is what I propose and advocate, is really a three-phase process. Teach, force, reinforce. The teaching part, I think everyone has an easy time understanding what treat training is. You reward proper behavior with a treat that the dog really likes. And I think you should, everybody who's raising a young pup should find out pretty fast what kind of treats that particular dog just really loves. When I would take dogs in for training, I would go out to train those particular dogs that I'd just gotten in, and I would have a pouch of small little hamburger balls that had been fried up previously, because I found that I have not met a dog yet that didn't like hamburger balls.
And or a human, for that matter.
Or a human. And, of course, we all get hungry in the field now and then. But it makes a terrific reward. And so calling the dog to you is very easy. All you do is just back away, here, 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 and here comes the dog. And then you just stop and let him get to you. And, of course, he's rewarded with a hamburger ball. So that's a very easy teaching form. And a lot of people use kibble and dog bones and other things. But I just went with surefire. They all love those little hamburger balls. So the teaching aspect is pretty simple. You can guide dogs into a sit position. You can guide dogs to do things like kennel and lie down and that sort of thing, and just reward them with a treat. So that's the teaching part, and that goes very simply, but you can't leave it there because you cannot rely on training that has merely been taught. And this is where force comes in. Now, I encounter a lot of people at my seminars. I don't mean a high percentage, but there's always consistently someone in the crowd who, when you say force, they kind of cringe and say, oh, no, not my baby. You're not going to force my baby. There are a couple of words that are really important to dog training, force and pressure, which mean about the same thing. But there's nothing, when you look those words up in the dictionary, that implies an amount.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas some people who are very tender-hearted toward dogs recoil when you say force, they're viewing it as brutality, and they're not synonymous at all.
you know, I've heard it described as force of will, as opposed to what we see. The outward manifestation quite often is pain. Is there a distinction there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I meant when I said that there's nothing in the definitions of force or pressure that implies an amount. It takes more pressure or more force to produce pain, but that's not your objective.
So,
and I should add to that that your objective when using force or pressure in dog training is not to force a dog into submission. It is to stabilize his responses. The reason we use pressure in dog training is to change their behavior. When a tiny, minute amount of pressure is not changing your dog's behavior, you're no longer training, you're only nagging.
There's a term I haven't used in the dog training world, but it is so appropriate. We often nag our dogs, don't we?
Indeed.
And it's just like when somebody nags us, we tune it out. I'm just convinced. You've just hit on something that I think someday we'll talk about that in particular on a whole podcast. Right now, I'll let you take a breath, sip a cup of coffee, because I'm going to make a quick commercial announcement or two. And then right after that, we're going to get back to a question from a listener and a dog training subject that I think you know a little bit about, Evan, so hang tight. And here is my chance to thank Dakota283.com. That's the address for Dakota283. Dog crates, kennels, gear storage, all roto-molded resin that is virtually unbreakable, made to military specifications because they make stuff for the military. Learn more at Dakota283.com. One of the things that is most enjoyable for Flick in his Dakota 283 are the big holes that allow lots of air in during the summer when we're traveling from training site to training site. He can breathe deep without getting too hot. In the wintertime, of course, the stainless steel doors and locking mechanisms will live outdoors quite comfortably and also allow you to see in a little bit better than some of the other doors on some of the other manufacturers' products. Learn more about all of the new lower pricing strategies at Dakota283.com. Hello, can you hear me there? Can you hear me now? Yeah, probably because you haven't shot enough. That's Jack Homa's job at ESP America to make sure that you can continue to hear long into your hunting and shooting career. You know, hearing loss is cumulative, and while it's easy for most of us to put some sort of protection on at the range, it's a little bit less common to see people wearing hearing protection in the field. That's the joy of custom-fitted hearing protection, and ESP America can do that for you. You don't have to go to the sports show and stand there, be on display while some guy fits you right there in the booth and everybody walks past and points at you. Don't worry about all that. You can do it right at home in your own hometown at a local audiologist, and Jack and everybody at ESPAmerica.com will reimburse you for that as part of your purchase price. Hearing loss is cumulative. Heed the warnings and learn more at ESPAmerica.com. And with that, we're back to Evan Graham and the Upland Nation podcast. Evan Graham, the author of the Smart Work System, I'll call it. Is that a fair way to describe it, Evan?
It's the way I describe it.
System. So it's a way of thinking. We all ought to probably take a little bit more of a systematic approach, and that's what I like most about this whole thing and the way you're thinking about it. Evan, this is actually really about flushing breeds, but you've dealt with that as a part of your whole retriever training thing. Had a listener ask me a question about ranging and how far a dog should learn to range and how we can help with that. Have you got any suggestions? And then I'll share my thoughts on keeping a flushing dog within gun range, however you define that.
Well, how much range you're going to allow is personal preference, of course. I don't really like to hunt with dogs that range a lot.
Yeah.
Most of my upland hunting is for pheasant, and we drive for pheasant. And so we've got blockers and guys who are, we generally have two or three dogs that are working our way through a field or a portion of a field and have blockers at the end. So those dogs are encouraged only to work within the outer limits of gun range. How we control that has a relationship to how we taught here. Now I use e-collars, and I'm a big, big fan of them. And one of the things that I collar condition them to, the final portion of their formalizing of that command, is e-collar conditioning. And the last part of that is multiple blasts of the whistle, the toot, 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 that means the same thing as your verbal hear command. Excuse me. So when they range, I do that multiple tooting of the whistle. I call it trilling, and I trill it rather lightly rather than giving the dog a hear command. For example, if I'm calling the dog in from a distance, a real sharp toot toot is like my being right there with him and saying hear, and he should come all the way to me until I tell him to do something different. Trilling is just to stop the dog's progression of distance and cause him to stay right in that range. It's kind of hard to verbally describe, but pretty easy on video. I produced a DVD called In the Field, and Quarter and Flush was part of that program.
So are we actually basically letting a dog go as far right as we want them to go, and then basically calling them right back to us, and then letting them go as far left as we want them to go? But the key is, they come to us each time and check in?
No, I don't call them all the way in. That's why I use the trilling. They just don't go any further away.
Ah, all right.
And what they do tend to do is check in with you when you trill a little bit. They just don't come unless they're called. So when they do check in with you, and when they look at you, if they're, for example, right of where you want them to be, these are handling dogs and they've been taught to take hand signals. And so I use a left-over hand signal gesture and just influence the dog to the left. And that's something that you can kind of visualize working a ditch or a brush row, something like that. And if you want the dog to work back and forth through that ditch or that brush row, you can handle them through that without calling the dog into you.
Some of the Cocker guys and the Springer guys will put somebody on each side and a little bit ahead of them, dropping birds every once in a while. You ever experimented with any of that?
I sure do.
Is it something you...
That's part of my quarter and flush drill.
Great. Okay. So the point of that is, you put the birds where?
Oh, if this is a drill?
Yeah.
I'm only going to give the birds to my helpers.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a road or a ditch or some distinct terrain feature, and a helper on each side, and they'll each have a bag of birds. When I mentioned trills, I'm just going to let the dog do whatever he wants, I'll just go explore. But when I trill the whistle and he looks at me, if I gesture to my right, the guy that's on my right, who's out there at, say, 40 yards, he's going to be the one that's going to toss a bird and let the dog go and get it, bring it to me, and then I'm going to release the dog to go on the hunt again on his own. When I trill the whistle again, I might cast him to the left, and the guy on the left is going to throw a bird for him. But he's going to find it rewarding, changing course out there. It's not formal handling, but it's related to it.
Sure. So he's forming some ideas in his head about, hey, this is where they are, so I'm going to stay in this range, if you want to use the term.
You bet. And then the logical progression from that is to pre-plant some in a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Like there'll be a line on the left and a line on the right, of birds that are going to be maybe 30 yards apart. So the first birdie comes to on the right-hand side. Once that's picked up, then I'm going to send him hunting again, and I'll gesture him to influence him to the left until he's picked one up over there. And we're going to go about 30 yards further each time, working our way right and left across a road or a ditch or whatever the feature is.
You know, all of it ultimately boils down to the biggest challenge that many part-time trainers / amateurs, or, you know, whatever you want to call them, have, and that is bird contact. Do you see that in your seminars and in your feedback from other people, that if, you know, many folks are not giving their dogs enough bird contact?
Yeah, and I empathize with that, because not everyone has a place to keep birds, especially live birds. But one of the things on my Force Fetch video, it's called Smart Fetch. One of the things that I teach on there is conditioning a dog to work real birds as efficiently as they work bumpers, mm-hmm. training dummies. And one of the things I teach to do that is use frozen birds. And I show them how to literally take like a dead pigeon and smooth its wings next to its body and put them down inside of like a paper lunch sack and smooth that out and then twist it closed and freeze them that way. There's two reasons for that. One is when they come out, they're a uniform, smooth shape that the dog can handle readily and efficiently. But the other thing is, moisture tends to form on birds that you refreeze. That paper sack will absorb the moisture, and your bird will come out dry.
You have just saved my bacon, pardon the pun. That is one of my pet peeves, Evan Graham, and I want to thank you for helping everybody listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That is something that happens every day at our house. I'm a big believer in dead frozen birds, but that is the gripe I have. So that leads naturally into the selfish and greedy question that I alluded to earlier, and that is, my German wire-haired pointer, and you cringe when I hear that, because you know that I'm going to next say, he works great on frozen birds and even partially thawed birds. When that bird is completely and totally thawed, soft and warm, he tends to want to chew a little bit. So help me and everybody else through that.
Okay, it's a progression. So we're, of course, at the beginning when I'm talking about frozen birds. And I take the dog through the whole force-fetch progression using frozen birds, whereas I used to use bumpers. Mm-hmm. I just make a transition into that. Do you guys, when you train, do you force to pile?
Many pointer guys do, but I'm not at that point yet.
Okay. Well, that's part of my sequential program for force fetch. And so I start with a mini pile, which is three bumpers, and they're laid perpendicular to each other about 10 feet apart. And there's just three of them. And I teach the dog to fetch the first bird he comes to and return and deliver. Then he goes to the next one, fetches the first one he comes to, and returns and deliver. And then eventually it turns into a nine bumper pile. Well, whereas those were bumpers before, now I'm going to do that with frozen birds. And then over time, over the course of a few weeks, if it's necessary for a given dog, and some dogs, as you know, are mouthier than others, I start using birds that are partially frozen and a little more defrosted and a little more defrosted, so that eventually I've worked them and transitioned them over a course of weeks into fully thawed birds at the beginning of the sessions. Only when I've done that, and only when the dog is working those birds properly, do I start shooting fly flyers for them. Because as you just mentioned, it's a different ball game when it's a fresh shot bird. I even took a dog to a hunt test for a friend of mine, and she was a very well-trained dog, and she'd had a lot of shot flyers. And I don't know if it was the bird supplier at this particular hunt test on this day, but they had a triple, and the last bird down was a shot flyer. And she went out, and she nailed the mark. She picked up the duck and started to turn around brought it back and just spit it out. And this was a fully force-fetched dog. So that had just not ever happened before. And so I thought, maybe something's missing from my training program. And if I could pause, and this is a personal thing for me, Scott, I really caution newer trainers not to blame the dog. And something like that happens, the first thing you ought to think about is, what did you do wrong, or what didn't you do thoroughly that caused the dog to do this? Because that's the first thing that popped into my mind, was, what am I missing with this animal?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I went back and developed that progression to condition to fresh shot birds. And so I was able to do a progression into fresh shot birds, or that just, you never hit that particular speed bump. And that's what it was for her. It was just a speed bump.
You know, I'm going to reiterate that, because it is absolutely true. And that's, you know, that was the subject of my book, was paying attention to the dog and then realizing that many of the screw-ups the dog is manifesting are really our screw-ups. And we need to step back a little bit and look at that a little bit more critically, a little bit more often. Is that something you see when you're at a seminar? Are people, again, their thinking process needs a little refinement?
Yes, and I was just going to mention that at every seminar, I make a point of mentioning to people, and I know some of those people there are really experienced and some are not, but really all the things we want to see these dogs do as a result of our training are our idea, not the dogs. There are really just a very few things that dogs do by their nature. And we've learned to cultivate those natural tendencies into a very useful form for bird conservation. And so when we think about that, and we think about the mistakes the dog might make in the field, have some empathy for their mistakes, because there are mistakes. It's the result of something we've not done thoroughly, or just something we've done wrong,
well,
or incompletely.
Yeah, I agree, and you're absolutely right. And let's start the catalog. I don't expect we'd be here all day if we were going to complete the list, and then we'd have to refine it again tomorrow. But, you know, what are some of the things we do that you see and you just cringe about when you see it that we might be able to fix if we simply know that's what we're doing? What are some of our biggest mistakes?
Well, I think immediately toward the most common things, and we've talked about one of those already, which mm-hmm. is getting ahead of the dog. But also taking a dog hunting too soon. There seem to be an awful lot of people who really have it stuck in their minds that the sooner I can get that dog out in the field hunting, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really almost the opposite of that, in my opinion. They're not prepared yet. There's a lot of things that we can do, because this is this dog's life's work. He's going to do this his whole working career. And if you don't give him the tools, you have no reason to expect a good performance out there. And so when you're taking a dog out too soon, he may be too young, he may be too sensitive about things he hasn't been conditioned to, his obedience may not be together, his skills may not be sharp as they should be. And so I quite often find myself addressing that very issue with new trainers, and I consistently tell them, don't hunt him this year. You've got a lot of years to hunt that dog. Why don't you make them good years? Because you might go out there this year and cause yourself a problem he never gets over.
You know, is that why so many really good, observant people in the dog world, like you and many of the other folks who've been on this podcast over the weeks that we've been on, say, okay, if you must go out with that dog into the field, just let that dog be a puppy. Is that an interim solution? Is that a compromise for the people who just have to take their dog out?
Well, in a way it is, but make sure he's properly conditioned to gunfire.
Yeah,
if you're talking about going out to the field to hunt, make sure at least that that is thoroughly done and he gets excited about gunfire instead of scared. If that's done, then you can live with a lot of other things that the pup might do just because he doesn't have the skills.
Amen. Thank you. That sounds great. And we're living that over here. I just got a text message yesterday from one of our group members who did exactly that, and it all turned out great. So everybody out there, take it to heart if you have to. If you were to suggest that as a trainer, we were stocking up on gear, and you know, the classic list of all the stuff we need when we're training a dog, what are the top three or four things that we must buy or buy a lot of and then use the heck out of?
Well, whistle and a lanyard for any dog, any gun. I am a big fan of training ropes, particularly at the more basic levels, check cords. I tend to use a lightweight poly ski rope, and I just go to my local hardware store and buy some nice brass clips and rings. I put a ring on one end and a clip on the other, snap swivel. Then I make one that's about 25 feet long and one that's about 100 feet long.
Wow. Excuse me. 100 foot is a long check cord. Now I'm in agreement completely. Everybody buys the store-bought versions. That ski rope strikes me as the best check cord material because it's light. It doesn't wrap around things. But what are you doing with a 100 foot check cord?
Well, with a retriever, there are a couple of different methods to water force, and we haven't even talked about that, but it's the last skill set in formal basics for a retriever is water force and swim by, and you water force first. Now, some dogs don't take the lighter pressure water force that I like to do with the method that I contrived, and because sometimes I get brought a dog that's maybe a little older and he's already got a bunch of bad habits and he's 3-4 years old instead of a young pup, a pup under a year old that's more malleable. And so there is a water force method that I learned from D.L. Walters. And you put a rope on the dog and the long rope is on your side. I use the 100-foot rope not because I need the whole 100 feet, but that's so that I have it in case I need it. Another rope is attached to a separate collar on the dog, and it runs across the pond to the guy on the other side. We're doing this in a relatively small pond.
Sure.
But he's actually the one that tugs the dog into the water, and we put the pressure on the dog and relieve the pressure when the dog's in the water. And then, of course, I've got the long rope, so it doesn't matter if he swims around a little bit, because it's later in the session, when the dog gets really, he finds out it's really comforting to be in the water, they want to just swim around instead of just come back and get out of the water and get forced in again. So he might go 50, 60 yards. I don't mind at all. As long as I can keep the slack up and, you know, at some point I need to call him in, then I have the rope for a light weight, measure of force to cause him to come in. There's really not a lot of force involved in it.
Yeah, I would imagine not, especially in the water. They're floating.
But the nice thing about ski rope is it floats and you know where it is all the time. It doesn't get under the dog and get tangled. And, of course, it dries out easily. There's just a lot of reasons why I like poly ski rope better than I do cotton rope for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And cotton rope gets stiff after it gets wet and dirty a little bit. And yeah, all the arguments, we could spend all day on that as well. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Evan Graham. Learn more about Evan and his training philosophy and his smart work system at evan-graham.net. Seminars coming up, that sort of thing. It's all right there at evan-graham.net. If you were to encourage anybody in any way to do more of something with their hunting dog, whether it's one particular aspect of training or in the hunting field or anywhere else in the duck blind, it doesn't matter. What should we do more of that might help our dog and ourselves advance a little bit and become slightly better at all of the things we want to do?
the first thing on my list is spend more time with them, more personal time. And that's not about going hunting or training, just about being with them. Spend some time with them to keep fostering a good relationship with them, because for a dog to be a good, reliable hunting partner, he needs to trust you. And he'll trust you more the better he knows you. But as far as something you need to do in the field, once you've got your skills on board, spend all the time that you can training in realistic hunting situations. Expose your dog to what he's going to do for a living, where he's going to do it. For a retriever, that might be in the duck marsh or the kind of cover that you'll hunt pheasant in, because retrievers are used a lot for pheasant hunting. But for whatever you hunt with your dog, whether it's pointing dog or a flushing dog or whatever, expose your dog as much as you can to the environment he's going to be required to work in, and make sure that he honors the skills as much out there as he does when you're training.
Yeah, so it's training first, even in the new locations.
Yes.
Well, we've talked all around it, and I've learned a lot about what you like to do out there, but I've never figured out yet, because you're going to tell me now, Evan Graham, what is it about hunting and hunting dogs that gets you all squishy inside, excited about working with them?
Well, I could tell you a real Reader's Digest version of how I got into dog training.
Yeah.
And that I had hunted all my life, but I've never been waterfowl hunting. And I was a firefighter paramedic, and a firefighter that worked with me had duck hunted for quite a few years, and so he introduced me to it. And so I went down to a place where he had gone and paid a guy for a blind to shoot out of. And I didn't know anything about it. I didn't have a duck call. I wouldn't have known what to do with it if I had one. But I managed to shoot a duck, and it fell in cattails across the water from me, probably 75 yards away. And I thought, well, I'm done. I don't have waders on. I've got a boat, but I mean, by the time I get over there and rustle around in those things, I'm never going to come out of there with that bird. And about the time I was feeling frustrated about that, I heard an outboard motor. And there was a channel behind my blind, and a guy was coming in from deeper out in the marsh. And as he got closer, I could see there was a big black lab standing in the bow of that boat, and his limit of ducks laid across the seat of the boat. And I said, that's for me. And that's what got me into dogs.
You know, you are the poster boy for the argument, conserve game, hunt with a trained dog.
Absolutely. As I know, even a poorly trained dog, even at this stage of my training career, I know even a poorly trained gun dog could have gotten over and rooted that bird out because of his nose. And I wouldn't have had to waste that beautiful mallard.
So to this day, that's your goal in life.
Well, it kind of is. I mean, I get an awful lot more out of hunting now. I'm quite happy to go hunting now without a gun. I'll go with my buddies, and I'll call, and I'll work the dog, and just have a great time joking with each other and let them shoot my limit. I wouldn't mind that at all. I just love being out there.
You know, I talk about this a lot, and I'm going to start conducting a survey of all my interviewees. There is a point in time when the shooting and the killing is way less important than all the other stuff out there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you know how it feels to go out on those serene early mornings, you know, mist on the meadow kind of mornings. And there's no place else like that. You just have to go out there and be there to really appreciate it. And that doesn't involve shooting. Being out there in that beautiful place with a dog is even better.
And if it's a good dog, even better than that.
Better yet.
Well, Evan Graham, it's been a pleasure speaking with you actually kind of in person, as opposed to trading emails or Facebook messages. I'm so grateful you could join us. Everybody out there, learn more about his system and how it works at evan-graham.net. Pick up the Smart Work books. There's videos. He's got seminars all the time on the calendar. Evan, I'm going to turn you loose, and we're going to continue our discussion here at the Upland Nation podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
I enjoyed it greatly, Scott.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And with that, our next sponsor's announcement. You want to save 10%? Well, it's easy at Dogtra.com. As you know, I'm using the Dogtra T&B dual collar system on Flick for two reasons. Number one, one handheld transmitter, if you will, with two sets of buttons so I can control two collars very easily without toggling back and forth. With Flick, it's all about force retrieving. And I don't mean lots of force, but I mean force of will and steadiness to birds in all manifestations, whether they're sitting on his shoulder, on the other end of the woe table, or flying off in the distance. I can do both with both collars at the same time and still have a hand free to do something else. If you're interested in finding out more about it, go to Dogtra.com. And for any purchase of any sort, over $200, free shipping and 10% off if you use our coupon code SLUN10 at Dogtra.com. Now, you know that I hunt a lot of private spots on TV. The show's Wing Shooting USA, and I invite you to watch it and enjoy it. But when I'm not on television, and even sometimes on television, I'm hunting public ground, the same ground you are, in the same ways you are, and I have the same challenges finding those places. That's what this feature, This Land Is Your Land, is all about. Thank goodness, sometimes, for the Bureau of Land Management. That's the federal agency that's basically in charge of all of the stuff that nobody else wanted, particularly in the West, but even up in Alaska and some of the Midwest. The BLM handles millions of public acres, including some in Nevada, where they've, well, repoed some of that land, where they've taken over some of the land the states simply didn't want. And in Nevada, most of that is hot, dry, desert, perfect for quail. Tracks near the town of Tombstone in Nevada will hold scalies and gambles quail. And along the shoreline at Lake Havasu, if you're looking for a great winter destination, you'll find gambles quail. Just get the maps for the area. Find the big yellow patches. That's BLM land. Make sure you got your license. Be safe and enjoy yourself. It is all about this land being your land. Hey, our newest sponsor is TagSafari.com. You'll learn more at TagSafari.com. They are unique in so many ways, and I'm very excited to announce some of them right here every week on the podcast. They're the only upland hunting and shooting shirts made from hand-picked, 100% long-staple African cotton. Not only is it picked in Africa, it's loomed in Africa, it's sewn in Africa, and it's broken in for you in Africa. All those things not only make the best upland hunting apparel, they also keep a whole lot of Africans employed. Learn more at TagSafari.com, and just for being an Upland Nation listener, you can take 15% off anything. 15% off any purchase at TagSafari.com. Just use the code TAGLINDEN15. Tag Linden15 will cut the price by 15%. Okay. Once again, reminder, Dogtra T&B dual collar, 10% off. SLUN10 is the code. over $200 purchase, and you'll also get free shipping, dogtra.com. Well, it's time for our soon-to-be legendary Upland Nation trivia question. So listen up, because who wouldn't want one of those 16-ounce Yeti Rambler tumblers? All right, out here in the Midwest and the West, we have a bird that sometimes is described by some of us as the king of game birds, and other times not so nice a name, including the ditch parrot. If you know the real name for the bird some call ditch parrot, then send your answer to me at scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com. Good luck. Somebody's going to be taking home a Yeti Rambler. And that brings us to the end of the show. I sure appreciate your listening. Thank you, Evan Graham, for being with us and enlightening me, and I hope some of you out there as well. Please tell your friends and give us a good review if you enjoyed the show. If not, tell me what you'd like to see changed. Check us out at the Upland Nation Facebook page and at uplandnation.com, where you can download all the podcasts. And of course, it's all free. And this time of year, I'm safe to say that I hope you're having a good season, and I hope we meet up sometime in the field. Thanks again for listening.